Hello and welcome. I'm Pooja Sarkar and you're listening to the podcast from the bookshelves of Forbes India. Today's book is called How to Lead by David M. Rubenstein. He's a philanthropist and of course the co-founder of one of the largest private equity firm in the world, the Carlyle Group. The book gives an insight into David's life, what he thinks are some key leadership skills, and a selection of interviews that he has done over the last few years. One thing that stands out is his ability to coax these leaders to talk about their background and how they manage to scale their businesses, their leadership skills, their failures, and how they rewired themselves. For example, there's a very beautiful story where he's in conversation with Jeff Bezos, and apparently David had sold his stake in Amazon in early days for some $80 million. Now that stake is today worth $4 billion. I totally loved reading these stories. Also, I just realized while recording this, David and Steve Schwarzman actually started their private equity firms in different parts of America, but in 1987. Both come from modest Jewish families. I wonder if they are friends. Maybe I'll ask them next time, but for now, let's speak to David about his book. Thank you so much for being on our podcast. I'll start first. Is it really a sequel to your first book, or how do you define this book? How did you come up with the idea of this one?
Okay. About 6 years ago or so, Bloomberg Television asked me to do television interviews for them on Bloomberg TV about prominent people and talk about leadership with them. And so after about 5 or 6 years of these interviews, I thought it would be a good idea to kind of distill them, give my own views on leadership, and put them in a book. It's a different than the kind of book I did before. The previous book was called American Story, and that is about American history. It is interviews that I did of great American historians in front of members of Congress in an effort to educate members of Congress about history. This is really designed to give people a sense of what leadership is all about, the key qualities, my take on it, and what the great leaders that I interviewed think about leadership.
Okay. How did you transition from being a lawyer to a private equity fund manager? And what are the leadership skills that you think you have helped you along the way?
Well, I say in the book, and I think it's true, that to be good at anything, to be a leader, you have to love what you're doing. And I really wasn't a good lawyer. I was a mediocre lawyer. So I didn't really see any great career prospects there. And so I took a gamble, as many people do in life, to try something different. I started a private equity firm in Washington. It grew to be one of the largest in the world. And it's now something that I take a lot of pride in. But as it became more and more successful, I decided I would get involved in trying to give away my money through various philanthropic endeavors. So I got very involved in the nonprofit area. And so the characteristics that I think I brought to the table in the nonprofit area and the business world were persistence, desire to succeed, willingness to share the credit, things that I describe in the book that I think are very important for leaders to have.
Okay. When you started out, you write in your book that, you know, you are far more focused on raising capital. Your three co-founders, but one of your focus areas was raising capital and then looking at other things. How important is it to be a generalist and a specialist in today's time? How has that panned out?
Well, I say in the book that one of the key ways to become a leader is to focus on a skill, master something so that you're the expert in your organization in that. And when people sense that you're an expert, they'll come to you and say, can you help me with this area that you're an expert on? And then gradually they'll say, well, there's something that's like the area you're expert on. You may not be expert on it, but you have a good skill set. Why don't you try something else? And gradually your expertise expands as more and more people get confidence in you. My firm needed somebody to raise the money at the beginning. None of the other partners wanted to do that. So I took on that skill and ran around the world for 25 years raising money for Carlyle. And ultimately I branched out into other responsibilities.
How has your leadership curve changed over the years? What are the skill sets that you had earlier, and how have you reskilled yourself?
Well, early on, I was a hard worker. I think hard work always helps. I tried to share the credit. I tried to lead by example. I tried to exhibit some humility and not try to brag about what I was doing. As you get to be better known in life and get to be more successful, you get greater self-confidence. So So today I have much more self-confidence, and therefore it feel easier for me to do certain things than maybe it would have been years ago. Many years ago, I might not have felt as confident giving an interview to you because I thought maybe I'd make a mistake or I didn't know what I was talking about. Today, I feel much more confident, maybe because of some of the success I've had.
Okay. There is something very striking about the book. For example, a lot of the leaders whom you've mentioned in the book and the stories that I was reading, a lot of them came from very humble backgrounds. Even if we look at you, your father was a postman and your mother was a homemaker. If you look at other stories, for example, Steve Schwarzman, he's been on our podcast twice, actually. He always talks about how he came from this Jewish family with a small retail store. If you look at Oprah Winfrey's story, again, she came from a very poor background. How is it that some of you guys who are such big names today have been able to start from humble backgrounds and been able to scale up at this level? What is it that keeps it going?
Well, as a general rule of thumb, in a society where things don't happen just by virtue of your birth, in other words, merit is valuable, it tends to be the case that people that come from more modest backgrounds feel they have to work harder. And when you work harder, some good things can happen to you. So Steve Jobs came from a modest background. Mark Zuckerberg's father was a dentist, but modest background economically. Even Bill Gates' father was a lawyer, but they were not fabulously wealthy. Elon Musk, modest background, and so forth. So the richest people in the world today and some of the most successful came from modest backgrounds. If you take a look at the presidents of the United States, with very few exceptions, they come from modest backgrounds. And the reason is, you grow up in a wealthy family or a privileged family, you don't have to work as hard. So it's very hard to instill a desire to work hard and drive in your children if you're wealthy. And that's the problem that all wealthy parents have. How do you give your children drive? And as we have observed over the years, wealthy parents often produce children who are not as much leaders as maybe the parents were.
Okay, and there's this line in your book which is pretty interesting, which says leadership in the second and third parts of life can be more meaningful and enduring for the individual and society. Can you explain to our listeners how do you bracket the first, second, and third, and where do you see success coming?
I divide life into three parts. The first third is probably you're growing up, you're getting educated, you're preparing for your professional life. The second third is when you're kind of starting your professional life and you're working hard to build a reputation for yourself and you're maybe succeeding or so. And then if you do succeed, the benefits in your third third are either the wealth you'll create, the reputation you'll create, and the desire you might have to give back to society. My observation is that many people who win the first third of life are the Rhodes Scholars, student body presidents, all American athletes in the case of the United States. These are ones that often don't turn out to be the leaders in the second and third third of life, maybe because they're burned out, maybe because they coasted too long, maybe because they didn't work as hard on the second and third third. So the people that are running the world, by and large, with a few exceptions, obviously, are people who are people that probably were not superstars in the beginning, but they got lucky, as I did, and in the second and third third of life, things happened to them. So in your country, for example, you have, let's say, your government leaders, to your current government leader came from a modest background, I believe. But the wealthiest person in your country came from a wealthy background. So, it's a mix. Your country may be different than the United States. But as a general rule of thumb, I think that people from more modest backgrounds will probably work harder. And while they may not be successful in the first third, they tend to get the benefits of being successful in the second and third third, and they will turn out to be the leaders of society.
What are the key characteristics that you see in a leader? I mean, you have mentioned a few characteristics in the book, if you could explain it.
Okay. Well, there are a number of ones that I describe in the book. Briefly, I would say luck, because everybody has some luck. You need to make your own luck, but luck is important. Hard work, a willingness to want to be a leader, desire to share the credit with other people, a rising to the occasion when crises occur, having some humility, I think is very helpful, wanting to give back to society and not just acquire material possessions is very helpful as well. I'd say that learning how to communicate so you can lead other people, you have to have followers, you have to communicate with them. Being highly ethical, I think, is very useful as well. Those are some of the things I think are very important qualities.
True. And in the book, you've written a line which says, humility came quickly and never left. I think right. It was after the episode where the election was lost, and you, by whether you were looking at it becoming a senior leader, but then you had the job, but the job was gone. So if you could talk about that, because in private equity, if you look at a lot of fund managers across the world, they don't really seem to be very humble in nature. So how is it that you stick to this quality of being humble?
What I was referring to was that I work in the White House for President Carter. I thought we'd be reelected. I'd get a more senior job and I'd be famous and so forth. But we lost the election, and all of a sudden people who told me how great I was didn't want to hire me in their law firms or whatever their organization might be. So it took me a while to find a job, and I kind of had to start at the bottom again. So it made me recognize the value of humility, because you have to be humble when you're starting all over again. On the point you've raised, generally people in life that get somewhere have failed, and failing helps them, I think, move forward because they overcome the mistakes that led to the failures. There may be some people in the financial services world that are arrogant. There are people in all parts of the world that are arrogant, but generally the people I think most people admire are people that have much more humility than arrogance. Yes, there are no doubt people that are running countries, there are people that are running corporations that are arrogant, but as a general rule of thumb, the people that are most admired are modest. Warren Buffett is a great investor, but I'd say when you meet with him, he's relatively modest.
Of the interviews that you have done, which are the ones that are your favorite, and if you can tell the stories that you really love?
Well, Jeff Bezos is great. I interviewed him in front of 2,000 people, and he has a great sense of humor. And I made note of the fact that I had known him when he was very young and getting started, and I didn't think his company was going to get very successful, and I kind of sold the stock that I had. Oprah Winfrey is a great interviewer, one of the most famous in the United States. It was a great interview. I suggested she could run for president of the United States, but ultimately, she concluded being Oprah is better than being president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Interviewed Warren Buffett, who's a very modest person. He's now 90 years old, but still going strong, and probably the greatest investor who's ever lived. Yo-Yo Ma is somebody that's quite well known as a cellist. And then there's somebody from India I interviewed, Indra Nooyi. And Indra Nooyi was a woman who left India. Her parents kind of said, okay, go to Yale and get your management degree. And then she picked up a trait that she had learned in India, which is the essence of it, is that she wrote letters to her employees when she was the CEO of PepsiCo. She wrote them to the parents of the employees, giving them report cards. And in effect, she was getting her employees to like her more because she was giving favorable report cards to her parents. And if your parents hear from your boss that you're great, it makes you think I should like that boss because she's saying good things about myself to my parents.
Great. I remember reading in the book where you talked about how, unfortunately, you did not have the requisite confidence in Amazon, and you had sold the equity for nearly $80 million. And at this time, it would have been worth about $4 billion. Are there transactions that you think I should have done?
Well, another one that I made a mistake on was when my daughter went to Harvard College, she met a young man that she's now married to, and he wanted to introduce me to his classmate from Harvard, who was a guy named Mark Zuckerberg, who was going to drop out and start a company. And he described it to me, and it sounded like a dating service for college students. And I said, that'll never get anywhere. So had I put in another $30,000 then, that would probably be worth about $20 billion today. So that was a mistake.
Okay. And talking about leadership skills, you started your own private equity fund. You started small and then it became bigger and it is now so big. How do you manage? How does one scale up from a small operation and to lead it to something so large?
Well, we wanted it to be small, but then we had a good record. We could grow in other areas. And we were, I think, one of the first private equity firms that say, let's go global. Let's invest around the world. And we can take our skills and try to do things around the world. And so we opened up in Asia about 20 years ago. And India, obviously, we have an office in Mumbai, and we've made a lot of investments in India in recent years, as have other private equity firms. And so it's a place that has been very attractive to us. but we've invested a lot in China as well, and in Southeast Asia and Japan and Korea. So we just basically started building one step at a time. If you think at the beginning you're going to build a great company that's going to conquer the world, you probably will make a mistake. So if you've got to start slow and let it build up gradually.
True. When it comes to managing operations of such large companies, how do you see the leadership differentiating at every level? I mean, are you looking at somebody who's just a specialist in something, or how do you choose your managers for each operations?
Well, gradually, you're always looking for people that can do a job currently well. And if they can do a current job well, you presume that maybe they could take on more responsibility. And as people rise up, you test whether they are really good at taking on more responsibility, whether they are arrogant, whether they get along with people, whether they can inspire people. What you really want to do when you're rising up is you want to inspire people to follow you. Because if you're a leader and people don't follow you, then you're not much of a leader. So in the business world, you have to have very good ideas. You have to make sure you've been successful in pursuing those ideas. And eventually people will say, I want to follow this person because he or she has pretty good ideas, and I'll be successful if I follow that person.
There's one question that a lot of people ask around when it comes to leaders is, do you really have friends when you become a leader up there?
Well, friendship is more complicated. As a general rule of thumb, you get to know a lot of people, and people will use the word friends. But when you get to be wealthy and famous, people usually want something from you. And so you have to be more on your guard that people are not just trying to get something from you, and they're not really your friends. So that's why you often find that real leaders, most powerful leaders, their closest friends are not in the business world with them. They might be people they went to school with when they were very young. They're people that aren't really looking for something from them. They just like their personality, who was somebody they knew before that person became famous. So you'll probably also find that most famous business people probably have relatively few friends, because it takes time to cultivate and nurture friends. And when you're rising up in the business world, how much time do you have to do that? Relatively modest. So you tend to hold on to old friends if you can, but making new friends that are really truly friends is harder.
True. And when it comes to giving away a part of your wealth when you become a leader, when did you decide that you will start giving away wealth, and how does the entire process pan out?
Well, Forbes magazine, you must be familiar with that magazine. They publish people's net worths. And one time they published mine, and it was very high. And I hadn't really told a lot of people that I might be as wealthy as Forbes thought. And so all of a sudden people started saying, well, geez, you have this much money. What are you doing with it? And I realized I didn't need to spend that much money. I'm not a big spender. So I decided I would start giving it away. And then Bill Gates came to see me and talked about the giving pledge. And so I signed up. I was one of the first 40 people to sign up for it. And I've decided in the end, the greatest happiness of life comes from giving away money or your help or your ideas to other people. And dying with a lot of material possessions isn't necessarily going to make you happy. So I decided that I would embark on that process and to try to give my children a good education and good values, but not to try to make them extremely wealthy because of my good luck.
Sure. And you're a part of so many organizations. You contribute to so many causes. How do you make time for so many things? Because I saw the entire page, I think more than two paragraphs were full with all the activities that you do. How do you get time? How do you classify?
Well, I don't follow what Jeff Bezos says, which is you need to get 8 hours of sleep every night. So I probably don't get 8 hours of sleep. I'm not doing anything I don't love doing. And when you love doing something, it's not work. So in all the organizations I'm helping, I love doing it. So it's really like a hobby or pleasure. So it's like if you have a hobby or something you like doing, this is what I like doing. So it's not work. I do have to, you know, manage my time carefully, but I don't spend a lot of time, you know, I don't play golf, and I don't, which saves a lot of time. I don't drink alcohol. That saves a lot of time. You know, I don't probably exercise as much as I do. That probably saves some time. That's not probably a good idea. But generally, you know, I manage to deal with all the schedule conflicts and do the best I can.
And you always talk about how you love finance and private equity is so good. What is it that makes you love private equity so much?
I do think in private equity, I facetiously have said it's the highest calling of mankind, which is obviously a tongue in cheek. But I do think you do have a chance to make companies that are not so wonderful better, and therefore keep people employed, create wealth for the investors, often whom are pension funds and so forth, and also create wealth for yourself, which gives you the opportunity to give the money away. So I do think it's a very good part of capitalism. It has its faults, like all parts of capitalism. I think generally private equity has worked reasonably well, and it has worked reasonably well in countries other than the United States. I think it's worked well in India as well.
Are you looking at any other causes that you would like to contribute to? Also, how has the COVID-19 pandemic has affected, I mean, it has affected everyone. What are the kind of causes that are you rewiring your strategy in terms of how to do philanthropy differently, or there are new sectors that you're looking at?
Well, of course, I've said in some interviews recently that I'm starting to give away more money. Of course, that's produced more people calling me for money. But I do think I'm probably increasing the amount of money I'm giving to the healthcare area, because COVID-19 has made us all realize how vulnerable we are. And as I have said in some interviews, it made me realize about my own mortality, because with COVID-19, somebody my age, you can get it in 2 weeks, you're gone. So it's not the same as these other kinds of diseases you might get, where you can keep yourself alive for 5 or 10 or 15 years with good doctors. COVID-19, you could die. So it has changed my perspective. I'm trying very hard to complete my bucket list before too long, and to give away my money more rapidly.
Sure. What are there on your bucket list, and how have you been spending these 6-8 months that we have been under this threat?
Well, my bucket list was to do an interview with Forbes India, and now I have checked that off. So that was on my bucket list. But I've also been living in my house mostly for the last 6 months. I haven't really traveled that much. I used to travel 240 days a year everywhere in the world. Now I just basically sit at home. I have, you know, various like TV studios in my home, and Zoom cameras and computer screens, and I go from one to another. So I'm not sure I'm doing anything other than gaining weight. Unfortunately, I think somebody is coming into my house every day and putting a new scale in that shows more than 10 pounds being gained every day. And so I have to find out why that my scale is changing. But I think I'm gaining weight by sitting at home too much.
And when it comes to your India operations, are you looking at increasing the pool of capital that is being invested in India?
Well, we have a very good team in India, and we have made a number of investments recently. We've agreed to do some others that haven't been announced, but we're very bullish on India. And it's a place where I first went in 1970. I went to India right after I graduated from college, and I spent about a month in India, in Calcutta, in Delhi, in what was then Bombay, and in Srinagar, on some houseboats up in Srinagar where the Beatles had previously been. And so I really admired India, and try to get back there if I can once a year. So like India. Now, I can't get there right now, but as soon as the pandemic is over, I hope to get back to India.
Lastly, before I let you go, the world has changed. The businesses are changing. We're seeing that capital markets are going up, but if you look at private market valuations, they are pretty subdued, and the economy is faltering. How do you see things are going to change in the next 1 year? How will the world change?
I think the stock market has been ebullient because the Federal Reserve in our country has put a lot of money in. The U.S. government and Congress has put money in. I think the underlying economy is not as strong. And I do think that we run the risk of a slowdown again. And so I am a little worried that the stock market might be higher than maybe where it should be. But remember, the stock market has been fueled by technology companies like Amazon, Apple, and so forth. If you were to strip out the technology companies, the big ones, the stock market isn't as wonderful as it might appear to be. So if you're in technology, it's great. If you're not, you got to be careful.
Cool. Thank you so much for your time. It was lovely reading your book and speaking to you today.